In the matter of State versus JV, can we please have appearances of counsel? Good afternoon to all counsel and welcome. Ms. Henderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Statutes are presumed to be prospective when they're enacted. In this case, the new juvenile waiver statute was enacted on August 10, 2015. The legislature determined that the statute should not take effect until 7 months later, which was March 1, 2016. In this case, the crime happened in 2013, 2 years before the statute took effect. The juvenile was waived up to adult court again in 2013, more than 2 years before the statute took effect. The guilty plea was entered in June of 2015, 8 months before the statute took effect, and he was sentenced on September 18, 2015, again 5 months before the statute took effect. On the date the statute took effect, the juvenile, at that time now a defendant, waived up to adult court, had no proceedings pending anywhere. He had not filed a notice of appeal. For all purposes, the case was done. He had been sentenced. I think it was like 9 months later, I think in September, he finally filed a notice of appeal. The case then proceeded on direct appeal. One of the issues was whether or not the new juvenile waiver statute should apply to his case. The appellate division determined that the new statute should apply, and they focused on the enactment date of the statute, which was August, and not the effective date of the statute. The appellate division did not explain why the enactment date should be the controlling date as opposed to the effective date. When you look at statutes, the savings clause is one of the first things that you would consider. And under the savings clause, you look at when the offense was committed, you look at when the penalty was incurred, or you can look at the proceedings that took place after the enactment of the statute. Under any of those scenarios, this case should not be retroactively applied, the new law. Clearly, the penalty had been imposed. It was imposed in September before the effective date. The offense was clearly committed before the effective date, and there were no proceedings thereafter, whether in the juvenile court or in the superior court after the effective date. For that reason, there should be no retroactive application. If you go beyond the savings clause and look at the general reasons for retroactivity, the first is, what did the legislature intend? Well, clearly the legislature intended that the statute would not take effect until 7 months after its enactment. So it didn't intend for it to take effect immediately. So you read into the legislation that obviously they didn't intend for cases from the day it was enacted in August until the following March, that any case within that time period is essentially going to be a nullity. That they put the effective date for whatever reason, but they felt that that was a date that was appropriate. I know the main focus in the argument, and certainly from the defense, is whether or not, the fact the statute has ameliorative aspects is controlling in deciding the retroactivity. We acknowledge there certainly are ameliorative aspects in the new statute, but that doesn't determine whether or not the statute applies retroactively, for the entire time. Well, you'd have to have a date on where you think it would end, because if you're saying the statute applies retroactively, how far back does it go? Certainly in this case, we don't think it should go beyond into this case because of the effective date. We also focused in our briefs that there have been ameliorative statutes before that have not been applied retroactively. Certainly when you look at 2C, when it took effect in 1979, it didn't apply to all the offenses that were pending under Title IIA or the offenses that had been already sentenced under 2A. They put a specific provision in the code in 2C1-1 that covered pending cases. It covered cases that were pending sentencing, it covered what procedure should apply, and it also had a provision for resentencing for individuals who were convicted of offenses before the effective date of the code and in terms of whether that should be resentenced or whether or not the crimes were still crimes under the code or if they were a different degree, which would affect the sentencing. That resulted eventually in the resentencing panel that dealt with all those types of cases. When the Drug Act was enacted, 2C3523 again provided for procedures that should apply when you're going from Title 24 to Title 2C now for drug offenses. And it also had provisions in there for resentencing in appropriate cases where they felt that the new law should apply. And in some cases, it required the consent of the defendant. Sometimes it did not. Most of the cases, well, also we have State versus Parolin, which was a No Early Release Act case that was before this court where the issue was the possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose. Under the original No Early Release Act, it wasn't a qualifying offense. And in the interim, while that case was going on, the new narrow law was passed, and it was no longer a qualifying offense. This court held that despite the fact it was no longer a qualifying offense, that the existing law did apply and the narrow sentence should be imposed.
Ms. Henderson?
Yes.
Suppose the same facts in this case, except for one, that the juvenile was 14 years old at the time the offense was committed. Should the judge have sentenced under the old law?
Well, it's depending on the timing.
Everything else is the same as the facts here. Just change the age of the juvenile.
No, I don't think so. Not at that point. I think if it happened at another point in the procedure, yeah, I think it would. I think if it was during when the waiver proceedings were going on or when the case was pending in the Superior Court, but I think once the sentence is imposed, the case is no longer pending for purposes of the retroactivity of the statute.
I suppose one of your strong points is that the legislature pushed forward the effective date 7 months. So even if we were to suppose there was pipeline retroactivity, within that 7 months, cases are going from pipeline retroactivity to beyond, which would have been defeating the so-called ameliorative effect.
Well, obviously, the seven-month period would be a concern.
Right.
And if the case was not final, I would think that the new law would apply, and that would apply to the individuals who were 14, who under the old statute could be waived up, and now under the new statute could not.
What do you think is final? What point is it final?
I think final is when sentence is imposed.
What about appeals?
Well, that's not considered final. It's final. That's when we get the right to appeal. And so it's in the court rule. It's in 2-2-1. It's in State versus DuSalt. They say that pending for purposes of this retroactivity is not pending on appeal. It's no longer pending when the sentence is imposed because at that time the conviction is final. When you look at other states, they're a little off the charts sometimes, but for them it's not considered pending once someone's been indicted or once the charges are filed. I think obviously that's not our law, and I don't think that's necessarily the way to go, to say if we indicted somebody or if we arrested someone and filed the charges, that the new law that took effect in that interim should not apply.
For savings clause purposes, the final is when the penalty was incurred. So whether the penalty was the waiver or the sentence, this law went into effect after that.
That's correct. And that could also be an argument right now because of this individual defendant. The penalty incurred, we win on all grounds under the savings clause. If he hadn't been sentenced by the adult court, we may be arguing that once the waiver decision was made, that's when the penalty or the decision that was made was relevant under the statute. But we don't have to make that argument here because he had been waived up, he had been entered a guilty plea, and he had been sentenced. But I think every case has to be looked at individually in terms of the timing of when things happened in the case and where you were in the process. And he clearly was beyond anything that would fall within the savings clause. There may be other individuals that I have not seen many cases on appeal involving this issue in terms of the waiver. Because even though it looked like there were approximately, I think, 161 waivers in 2014 and 2015, I haven't seen 160 appeals.
What would be the impact if we didn't rule in your favor on the class of juveniles who would be affected?
Well, I think if we don't win in this case, as I said, there's 161 waiver cases from each one of those years, and if a decision is out there saying that they're entitled to a new waiver hearing, potentially we could have, you know, close to 700 people coming back saying they're entitled to a new waiver hearing.
Wait, 161 for each of 2014
for 2015 and 2016. So I got them from the criminal report.
You cited numbers in your brief.
Yes.
Those are the ones you're relying on?
Right.
Okay.
I couldn't find anything more recent than that. I think the numbers are still being calculated, but
you're extrapolating those numbers from 2015 and 16 to the present.
Mm-hmm. It seemed to be fairly consistent that seemed to be the number, but it was definitely the number for those 2 years. I would have liked to have seen the numbers since the new law to see if there's been any difference in the amount of waivers, but I wasn't able to find any statistics on that in terms of the waivers since then.
Under the savings clause, is your position different than the AMICI, the County Prosecutors Association? Because you seemed before in your response to the chief to point to penalty as being the date of the waiver, and I thought your colleague is taking a different tack with regard to
penalty. Well, my position in the brief had been the penalty had incurred, because for our purposes in this case, everything had been done, and it was no appeal pending. There was nothing. Everything was done on the effective date.
Right. But this one is all wrapped up, but for those.
Right. But if the penalty had not incurred, let's say he hadn't been sentenced. Let's say the enactment date was the effective date. So that would have been after he pled guilty, but before sentencing, and the penalty had not incurred. I think we would have argued that the penalty for purposes of this statute was the waiver.
The date of the waiver
hearing. The date of the waiver.
Okay.
But that's not necessarily in this case, because we already have, we have both penalties. We
Understood.
Have the waiver and we have the sentence being imposed.
Okay.
There was a long gap before the notice of appeal was filed. Was the notice of appeal out of time, and was he given, allowed to file it nunk-pro-tunk by the appellate division?
I don't know why the notice of appeal was out of time, because clearly it should have been filed. If he was sentenced in September, his notice of appeal should have been filed sometime in November. It wasn't filed to the following September.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's a very, and there's, at least as far as I could tell in the record, there wasn't really an explanation for what happened there.
It was filed at a time, I don't know if, obviously it was filed at a time, defendant must have indicated he wanted an appeal, because in order to get it out of time, you have to say that you asked to have it filed at a time. Certainly in the interim, his notice of appeal was filed after, I think, the JF decision by the appellate division, which held portions of the Juvenile Act was retroactive. Mm-hmm. So that may have put people on notice to say, well, let's see if we have any, you know, people who were waived up that we didn't file the appeal on. But I don't know in particular why his case was out of time, outside of it might have gotten lost
speaking
somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of delays, what do we know from the record and the history of the statutory amendment of the reasons for delaying the implementation date, the effective date?
I don't know of any reason why. I've read it. I could not figure out why they did it. I mean, sometimes when they're obviously changing motor vehicle laws, they're giving time so motor vehicles can get their computers up to shape. I'm not sure why this was delayed implementation, because when I looked at the prior juvenile law, which was back in 2000, I don't think there was any time in between the effective date and the enactment date.
I think the defendant is saying that it had to do with data collection. Is that... Am I remembering that correctly?
That's what they're saying. I don't know why data collection would make a decision on why someone should have the new waiver procedures applied to them.
Was there anything to the notion about the Attorney General preparing guidelines? Is that part of...
Well, we haven't prepared any guidelines yet on the new statute. So, I think because the original guidelines we had were essentially incorporated into the statute. So, I think at the time, I think we're waiting now to see if additional guidelines are necessary, and if so, for what? Because under the statute involving, in this case, the prior statute, there was a distinction between individuals who were 16 or older in terms of whether or not there was a burden on the juvenile to show he could be rehabilitated by a certain age, and other cases where they were the Chart 1, where you were automatically essentially waived up if we met the probable cause criteria or whatever. So they were, the waivers went to the distinction between essentially the Chart 1 and the Chart 2 people. Here, since there's really no distinction between the Chart 1 and the Chart 2, it's unclear at this point what exactly guidelines are necessary. I think so far there hasn't been any litigation I've seen that have pointed out problems in terms of interpreting the waiver statute and needing additional guidance from the Attorney General. If that becomes apparent, then certainly that would be a way for the guidelines to focus on something that may be necessary with the new statute.
The new statute also called for some changes in custodial housing of juveniles. Could that have been related to the reason for delay of the effective date? There's no, because the effective date delay addressed all aspects of the amendments in this omnibus statute. Did you come across anything like that in the legislative history?
I didn't see anything in the legislative history that went to that. And quite frankly, corrections before the statute did move individuals who were juveniles waived up or youthful offenders
to
juvenile custodial
facilities.
Situations that were appropriate.
It seemed like there was a need for more space in juvenile facilities.
That may well be true, because if the number of waivers were going to be, you know, reduced, mm-hmm. there would have to be more space provided for juveniles. But I haven't seen that they've built any more juvenile facilities in that time period. But no, I don't know. You know, there was nothing clear in the legislative history that said, you know, why it's specifically being delayed, where other statutes have specified why it's being delayed.
Thank you.
Other questions? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Hughes?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. McNamara.
May it please the Court, I'd like to thank the Court on behalf of the County Prosecutors Association of New Jersey for the opportunity to address the Court regarding this issue of statewide significance. I think the path is fairly clear. The English language sometimes is subject to interpretation, but I'm not sure what language the legislature could have used to say this is a prospective statute other than saying this enactment occurs in the future. When we're talking about interpreting language, we join in all the arguments regarding the saving statute being dispositive. And to address one of the questions Justice LaVecchia had, in the context of this case, the County Prosecutors Association of New Jersey agrees that it doesn't matter what the definition of final is, because the saving statute applies, because here you did have a plea, you did have a sentence. The saving statute also talks about liability and penalty. So I think there's a very strong textual argument that in a case of a trial, the verdict removes the presumption of innocence from a defendant, so that may be a liability, but that's not necessary for the Court to address in the context of this case, because it's clear the terms of the saving statute apply. The legislature has, in many instances, addressed retroactivity of legislative reform. This Court has recognized that it's well within the prerogative of legislatures, and you've said legislatures are entitled to experiment and explore means which to advance public policy. The juvenile waiver structure in my 30 years has undergone at least three revampings. The legislature addresses what it perceives to be the public policy, and any piece of legislation other than perhaps appropriation legislation or a state proclamation, we're going to name a day after someone, can be considered ameliorative as the way you context. It's always addressing some sort of problem. So the saving statute would be a nullity if you just come up and say ameliorative means it's addressing a problem and it's designed to fix a problem. The appellate division has interpreted ameliorative in a specific way. You know, the word strike has 240 definitions. I suppose ameliorative has two, but the one that governs, I would suspect, in the context of interpreting criminal legislation is whether or not it decriminalizes conduct or reduces the ultimate penalty that the conduct could be punished by. Kendall versus Snedeker indicated that's an appellate division decision, and I think that's a fair interpretation if you look at your own cases as a workable standard. Ms. Henderson referred to Parolin. Parolin, I think, is a very strong indication that this Court uses the term ameliorative in the idea that it decreases it decriminalizes conduct or lowers a potential penalty, because as occurred in Parolin, an entire class of offender, those who committed the crime of possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose under the original enactment of the No Early Release Act, were no longer subject to that enhanced penalty under the new enactment, which regarded enumerated crimes. And this court said, no, the sentence imposed in Parolin stood. It was what the law required at that particular time. If I just may address the issue of final, what may also be final, the public defender is advocating some idea of final has to be tied to the idea that appellate procedures are complete, and they address some of the federal retroactivity principles in constitutional law. And again, if you look at those federal retroactivity principles, those were ultimately a decision made as a policy choice. The Supreme Court struggled with, under the Linklater Doctrine and the Teague Doctrine, how should constitutional rules be made retroactive? And eventually they landed in Griffith v. Kentucky on a bright-line rule. But I think you should also give note to the fact that there's no unified principle regarding retroactivity in the federal statute when the savings statute's involved, because the federal rule is the penalty is incurred at the time that the conduct is committed under 1 U.S.C. 109. So federal constitutional retroactivity regarding constitutional principles, yes, it has an appellate, is final, but under their savings statute jurisprudence, it can't be earlier. It's at the time of the conduct. That's their bright line rule.
You're talking about the federal law.
The federal savings statute, the penalty is considered to incur at the time of conduct. So I don't think there's a unified principle. And as we point out in our brief, it's impossible to divine a uniform principle from how other states handle this subject. Some states handle it differently. This court has recognized different portions of the statute should be assessed individually for whether or not it has retroactive effect. I do think, however, the saving statute is the beginning of the analysis. And if the saving statute is dispositive that the liability had occurred or that the penalty had incurred, you don't need to get into the Gibson versus Gibson three-step retroactivity.
It's the savings clause is the default provision. If the legislature can do whatever it wants.
Yes, certainly. And if they
But in the absence of any clear expression by the legislature, the savings clause applies.
Yes, we would agree with that, and that here there is a clear expression of the legislature. This statute doesn't become effective until this particular date. There is no real legislative history regarding the 7-month enactment. The legislation was posed, and it was litigated is the wrong word, but it was discussed, and it was handled with the idea of principles of rehabilitation becoming to the forefront of juvenile science. Obviously, this court's aware of Miller and its progeny, and Zuber and its progeny.
Could the legislature tomorrow amend the statute and make it retroactive to any juvenile who was waived up back to whatever date it decided to make it?
That would be well within the exercise of the legislative power. I'm not sure that would be an appropriate exercise of their power.
I understand, there's nothing that would stop the legislature from amending the statute to bring it back to whatever day it chose.
If that's what they chose,
that would be appropriate. You just said you don't think it would be appropriate, but if they do it, then it is appropriate.
You don't think it would be wise?
I would exercise my right as a citizen to campaign against that particular piece of legislation. Okay. As for the County Prosecutors Association, as an official position, I'm going to remain silent on that particular aspect. What I would also just point out is when the Criminal Justice Reform Act was passed, there were various enactment dates and enabling dates to allow the courts to begin to immediately create the risk assessment instrument for the Attorney General to provide for training. So the legislature knows how to pass a statute also with different, not necessarily enabling acts, but acts where the parties and stakeholders have to begin to do something to do it. Here they made a broad statement that the penalty should be, the statute should become effective in the future. this court has always said that statutes are presumed to be prospective unless the legislature says something different. And as Justice Alvin points out, there's a default statute regarding penalties and liabilities that fill the field for criminal legislation. Most criminal legislation regarding criminal activity is going to involve some sort of penalty or liability incurring at a fixed point in time. And I think it's clear, and the legislature could not have been clearer in enacting the savings statute and or this particular piece of public policy social justice reform.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, sir.
Thank you. Ms. Friedman.
Afternoon, and may it please the court. There is no doubt that JV has severe cognitive and emotional limitations, an IQ of 58, and attempted suicide at least 6 times while in pretrial custody. There is also no doubt that because the prosecutor analyzed waiver under the old statute, JV didn't have the opportunity to present proof of these limitations, and the prosecutor didn't consider these limitations in the waiver analysis. The only question before your honors is whether the revised waiver statute, which was passed 1 month before sentencing in this matter, and well before JV's case could be deemed final, should be applied retroactively to the waiver proceedings in this case. As the appellate division correctly determined upon applying a retroactivity analysis, it should. And this court should affirm for 3 fundamental reasons. First, as the appellate division correctly noted, this court has always looked at retroactivity analysis by first looking at legislative intent. And in turn, that question hinges on whether an exception to the general rule favoring prospective application applies. And as the appellate division correctly determined, the ameliorative exception applies. And that's both because the revised waiver statute falls within the ameliorative exception on its face and because its legislative history reveals that the legislature intended for it to be ameliorative. Second, contrary to the state's assertion, the savings statute is not dispositive in this case, because the savings statute is a statute of last resort that is only to be looked to if none of the 3 exceptions to the general rule favoring prospective application apply. And here, because the ameliorative exception applies, the savings statute is inapplicable. And third, even if this court were to find that the savings statute somehow applied to the analysis, this court should construe the penalty incurred language contained within the savings statute as meaning that a defendant's appellate rights have been exhausted. And here, because JV's appellate rights have not, in fact, been exhausted, this court should affirm. And that concludes my opening remarks. Now,
you're done with your opening.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back in time to the date of sentencing. Imagine the attorney representing JV at the time stood up and said, Your Honor, I ask that you send it back to apply the new statute. And the judge, ever well prepared, says that statute is not in effect, it doesn't go into effect until next March. Doesn't it seem strange at that moment to call for the application of a statute that is not yet in effect?
It would seem strange, but imagine, for example, Your Honor, and I would like to just throw a hypothetical back to Your Honor, which seems strange, I know, but imagine in another courtroom at the same exact time, in another county, another attorney said, Your Honor, I would like to adjourn this case because there is this statute that's pending that's going to go into effect. And the judge said, okay, fine, I'll adjourn it. Your Honor can see how there would be inequitable results stemming from the same exact statute with individuals that are otherwise exactly similarly situated.
So the hypothetical you pose goes to the question of the exercise of discretion on the part of the court.
Yes.
Our obligation today is to determine what the law provides.
Yes.
So how would What should have happened in that courtroom under the circumstances where the judge correctly said, there's no law for me to apply today. It doesn't yet have effect.
Perhaps the judge did not do anything wrong, but the question here is whether pipeline retroactivity should be applied. Just in many other cases that this court is asked to decide when there is a new rule, there's new decisional case law that is issued, and this court is asked to decide, is it limited retroactivity? Is it pipeline retroactivity? Is it full-blown retroactivity? Is there no retroactivity?
So
this court...
I'm sorry. Oh. I mean, you're talking about line drawing. And
yes.
What's interesting is you want the line to be drawn at pipeline retroactivity.
Yes.
Within that 6 months, cases went from pipeline retroactivity to beyond, correct? And you would admit within those 6 months the cases went beyond would not have relief, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So those are some of the so-called like built-in inequities. You're talking about like an adjournment for a couple of months. That might have made a difference. But the legislature draws lines, and some people fall within it, and some people fall outside of it, and that's the right of the legislature. Do you agree?
I do agree, and it always seems unfair to whoever falls outside of the line. But it seems that the difference would be that while someone is pending, while someone's appellate rights are still pending, before they have been exhausted, that individual still has a vehicle to ask the court for the rule to be applied.
They do if the legislature says they have that right. So did the legislature, from what appears on the face of the language of the statute, indicate that it wanted hundreds and hundreds of waiver hearings to be conducted anew?
Well, at the outset, I'd like to just say that I don't believe that it's hundreds and hundreds. According to the state's brief on page 26 of the AG's brief, in a footnote, it appears that the state says in 2015 there were 163 juveniles waived. 2015 was 161 juveniles. So if you do the math between the 7 months, it looks like it would be at most 93. But I know that doesn't get at the heart of Your Honor's question. At the heart of Your Honor's question, I think the question is, did the legislature expressly say that the statute should be applied retroactively? And my answer to that is the legislature didn't need to say that, because if it falls within the ameliorative exception, the legislature doesn't need to say it.
I'm trying to understand. We have curative and ameliorative. Do you distinguish between curative and ameliorative?
Yes. So curative refers to civil law, whereas ameliorative refers to criminal law. And
you're not contending there's any curative aspect of this?
No, Your Honor. And specifically, I have a quote, the ameliorative exception applies to criminal laws that affect a reduction in a criminal penalty, and that's Street v. Universal Maritime 300 NJ Super 578, and that's the Appellate Division 1997.
So why wouldn't the legislature, since we have a savings clause, which is a default provision, have just said that this legislation will apply to all cases that are pending final appeal? That would be an easy way of doing it, if that's what they intended.
Well, this court has always ruled that retroactivity analysis does not begin with the savings clause, but rather with two main questions. Did the legislature intend for the statute to be applied retroactively, and would retroactive analysis result in a manifest injustice? And in looking to that first question, legislative intent, it's true that there is a general rule favoring prospective application. I don't deny that. But this court has carved
out three exceptions.
What
role does the savings clause play? Are you saying it means nothing?
Absolutely not. I'm saying that the savings clause does not...
When should our court rely on the savings clause? When should we disregard it?
That I'm saying...
Oh, no, when should we rely on it?
Yes.
Tell me, go ahead with that.
Well, the savings clause should only be looked to after the three exceptions. And so if the three exceptions are inapplicable, then we look to the savings statute, because the savings statute doesn't somehow trump the three exceptions.
So what role does the effective date then have in the analysis?
Great question. So
thank you.
So the effective date.
Great answer.
So the
I'm assuming Justice Albin's questions weren't that great.
That sort of hurt.
So
you're doing fine. Keep going.
So the effective date has typically played a factor in the first exception. So the first exception is whether the legislature has expressly or implicitly indicated that the statute is to be applied retroactively.
Right.
The second exception is the ameliorative exception.
So before we get to that, by expressing an effective date in the future, what does that tell us about their express or implicit intent with regard to retroactive application?
It can either contradict an argument that the legislature wanted it to be applied retroactively, or it can bolster the argument, right? So
How does it bolster it?
Well, it depends, because there could be an effective date as of the day. The effective date can be whatever the legislature wants, right? And my understanding is that
it's defeating the ameliorative purpose, because you just said if even under your own structure,
right,
pipeline retroactivity, that 7 months is pushing off case after case after case beyond your ameliorative exception. Like, why would, so if they meant to have this ameliorative effect, why are they doing that?
Well,
are you following my question?
I follow.
Go ahead.
So, but the effective
date. She's not impressed, but she follows.
The ameliorative.
I've got that.
The effective date can also be the day of. And also, as the JF court found, the effective date isn't necessarily reflective of. This is a multifaceted statute.
Focus on the ameliorative.
Mm-hmm.
If we accept that argument, then the legislature would want this court to rectify as many cases as possible.
Right.
But yet that 7-month delay, even under your own regime, is meaning that case after case is going to fall outside our corrective umbrella, right? So why would they do that if their intent was ameliorative?
Except that the effective date isn't necessarily reflective of the legislature's intent to bar retroactivity with respect to the ameliorative waiver provision. It could have been, as the JF court found, reflective of the legislature's intent to get the various agencies up to speed with respect to the reporting requirements. So subsections C and G of this statute require rather onerous reporting requirements of the AOC, the AG, the JJC, and all the county prosecutors for data collection and reporting for race, ethnicity, age, gender, and processing times to report to both the governor and the legislature. And as the Assembly Appropriations Committee found in a June 15, 2015 statement, quote, the reporting requirements may require additional manpower for collection, analysis, and creation of reports. So it wasn't necessarily that this effective date is dispositive of some purpose to delay the waiver, but rather that the legislature wanted to make sure that the agencies all got up to speed.
So the way around that for the legislature is really simple. It needs one sentence. It says, notwithstanding that the effective date shall be X date, any juveniles who is, you could base it on obviously a number of different mileposts in the juvenile's history, will be covered. There could be one sentence to make it all clear. and we don't see it. We see instead a delayed implementation.
It could have been, except that the legislature is presumed to be aware of this court's case law carving out an exception for ameliorative legislation.
Let me ask you about that, and you've made a very well reasoned argument that this is a juvenile justice reform, that the goal of the legislature is to reduce the number of children who are incarcerated in adult facilities, and yet we see in this statute what we so often see in statutes, which is here's our policy, and we think it's a better policy than what existed in the past. And we see that obviously in criminal statutes, we see it in civil statutes, we see it all over the place where the legislature is saying, we are now reforming the law because the policies of the past haven't worked or are unfair or whatever. We are making an improvement to policies. Now, your adversaries say that if this is ameliorative, then so is just about every statute that the legislature enacts. I'm not sure I would go with naming a day after Justice Alvin or something like that, but when they reform the law, you see a groundswell of support and explanation as to why the policies of the past were not working. Why is this statute different from all of those other statutes?
Because it indirectly reduces penalties for children by keeping them out of adult court and thereby reducing and shielding them from the harshest of penalties that we typically reserve for our adult offenders. And even, let me give Your Honor an example. In this case, my client received 18 MIRA. 18 years is 0 to 18. That's an adult life as we typically think of it. If he were to be tried in family court, he would receive 4 years for that same attempted murder offense. 4 years is the length of high school, which children think of as an eternity in and of itself. So 4 years versus 18.
So how about 14? Think of all the 14-year-olds, okay, over the last couple of decades who've been waived up in murder cases and gotten 30-year sentences, mandatory, whereas had they remained in juvenile court, the maximum sentence, and it would be non-MIRA, would be 20. Okay. So you can, now it's 15 years. Did the legislature intend us to go back 20, 30 years and remedy all of those cases? All of those juveniles, had they had their waiver hearings today, would be in juvenile court because it was 10 years, 15, 20 years ago. They're walking around with adult convictions and many of them may be in prison, still serving their time. Has the legislature indicated any intention to correct that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, but thankfully for this court, all those people are probably out of the pipeline, so.
I want to come back to the construct that you've described for us. If the legislature is clear in saying a statute would be prospective, in this case, for example, had it said the effective date will be a year from today and the law will apply only to offenses committed on or after that date, would you get to the exceptions?
Can you repeat that question?
Would you then consider whether the statute was ameliorative?
If what, Your Honor? I'm sorry.
You have an express statement by the legislature that the law is prospective, mm-hmm. Would you consider any of the exceptions as you understand the way the law should be applied?
No, Your Honor. If the legislature expressly says that the law is prospective, then we would not go on.
So then if the court did not accept your argument and concluded that the effective date is a clear statement of prospectivity, would that end the analysis?
I believe it would, yes, Your Honor.
Anything else you'd like to present?
I would like to add that the state's argument regarding the notion that my client somehow gamed the system in delaying the appeal is simply not true. My client, as I submitted in my appendix, submitted in as part of his as within time certification, that the reason that he did not submit his notice of appeal as he didn't submit it in time was because he didn't understand his rights, which really goes to the heart of this appeal in general. He has severe cognitive and emotional limitations. He had no idea that the law changed, and to be honest with your honors, he has no idea what's going on to this day. So the mere notion that he somehow tried to game the system because of the revised waiver statute or because of JF is simply not true. I was the one that came up with the idea to argue that the revised waiver statute should be applied retroactively. His family is watching this, and for them to hear that, I'm sure, is very hurtful for them because he has an IQ of 58.
No, I think, was that in response to my question? I just was wondering what happened.
No.
I was wondering what happened as a matter of fact. It was an as within
of
time
course,
that was granted, right?
Yeah.
Is that what happened? Okay.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Oh, we understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'm pretty excited to rank the quality of your questions. We'll save that till the end of the argument.
In writing, please.
You need not tell us.
Only if we get to rank your argument.
I'd like to focus on the effective date and the impact of it and why it's there, because the answer actually seems quite plain to me. The statute made dramatic changes to the waiver law, but that is but one part of it. Additionally, it changed the way the JJC used solitary confinement, called room restriction. That required extensive regulatory change from the JJC. It meant that even waived children would now be housed not in the DOC until age 21, but in the JJC, requiring reg changes from both the DOC and the JJC. What else did it do? It did a lot of other stuff. But no, let me tell you some of the other things it did. There was a feature where the JJC, when they had someone who had been adjudicated, not waived, who was over 18, who was misbehaving, they were able to transfer them to the DOC with no due process. That was an issue that had been litigated in the lower courts. This statute created the right to counsel, so the public defender had to provide counsel, requiring regulatory change. So there were significant, in addition to the data collection, there were a lot of regs that needed to be put forth, not by the Attorney General. It wasn't their guidance on waiver. It was regs in the other parts of the statute. So I think that is a very clean explanation for why they would ask for 7 months. Justice Patterson, to your point, of course, they could have been cleaner by saying 7 months applies to the things that require regs, doesn't apply to the waiver, which is going to be prospective only, or is going to apply to people in the pipeline. They didn't do that. But I think what we have to get to is the ameliorative question. And it's interesting. Today, the Attorney General's position is, look, of course, there's some things about this that are ameliorative, but here's why I think we still win. That's not the position the Attorney General took in its brief. In its brief, the Attorney General said, listen, we know this statute isn't ameliorative, and here's how we know it, because you said so in NH. Now, you didn't say that in NH. In fact, in NH, what you said is, for the purposes of discovery, the old statute and the new statute are substantially similar.
NH doesn't really answer the question.
It doesn't come close to answering the question. But in the briefing, the Attorney General doesn't address head-on the question of amelioritiveness, if that's a word, but whether or not the statute is ameliorative. But so let's talk about it, because I think Mr. McNamara cited to the case that explains how you decide what an ameliorative statute is. I think that's the right citation. I don't think what it means is everything is ameliorative. I think on the one side of the coin you have ameliorative statutes, and we're talking about criminal statutes here, and the other side you have ex post facto laws. We don't let criminal laws apply retrospectively when they make the punishment harsher because there's a prohibition against ex post facto.
So you think the ameliorative analysis can override an express legislative expression regarding applicability date?
I do not. I give the same answer that Ms. Friedman does, which is if there's an express statement of prospective analysis only, that ends the inquiry. In the absence of a clear statement, and I don't think the effective date is for the reasons I started my presentation with, then we look to the ameliorative nature of it.
So you need some ambiguity first before you get to ameliorative.
I think that's a fair way to frame it.
Okay.
Our drug statutes, 1,000-foot, went from mandatory to discretionary. That would be ameliorative, correct?
People
who were mandatorily sent to prison might not have under the discretionary scheme, correct?
I think that's fair. I'd have to look at the whole statute, but I think that's fair to say that it's ameliorative.
Was that retroactively applied?
That was not. Given
the effective date of that and the effective date of this, how is it different, other than the fact that we're dealing with juveniles here?
I think here you have much closer to a clear statement of there is an entire class of people who should not be subject to this punishment. Now we want to give more discretion to judges in deciding. Chief Justice Ravner, you started the questioning of, I believe, Ms. Henderson, by asking about, would the analysis be different if we were talking about a 14-year-old rather than a 17-year-old with severe cognitive limitations and mental health concerns? And I think I want to answer that by using a plumbing analogy, which is a little risky for me. But the 14 question is a valve, right? It's a flapper valve. You're in or you're out. If you're 14, you used to be in, now you're out. Whereas the changes that we're talking about today are more like a sieve. What they're saying is there are some 15 through 17-year-olds who we think should make it through the sieve and into the adult system. Mm-hmm. But we want to use this sieve to catch the people who are insufficiently culpable, people with serious mental illnesses, people with serious cognitive limitations. And those people, we want to be categorically excluded from the harshness of the adult system, from the 18 NERA, but from the permanency of a criminal record.
I would have thought that the 14, 15 would be a stronger case for you.
My plumbing analogy perhaps clumsily, I'm trying to say both our legislative intent of saying these are people who we don't want to face this punishment. 14-year-olds under any circumstance, and 17-year-olds when they have such severe cognitive limitations that we think they're insufficiently culpable.
But these are factors. I could see the argument if the new law said someone who has cognitive disabilities should be included with the 14-year-olds who we've just taken out of the system entirely. But this is a group of factors, obviously very significant. Two new factors are involved, but it's the judge's analysis that weighs all those factors.
Justice Patterson, that's correct. It's three new factors.
Three
it's
new
age
factors.
And maturity.
Yeah, age and maturity. Right. Yeah,
but and that's because these things are necessarily require a qualitative weighing, not just a quantitative assessment, unlike the 14-15 age threshold. And so JV is severely cognitively limited with an IQ of 58. You could have someone with an IQ of 85 where it would be a relevant factor, but not dispositive. But that's why the remedy that the appellate division crafted in this case is appropriate. They didn't say remand for a judgment of adjudication in juvenile court because the waiver has been denied. They said just give him a hearing where he gets a chance to say, because my limitations are so severe, because my mental health concerns are so serious, I should be adjudicated in family court, not adult court. And to be clear,
I appreciate the argument you're making about the individual about whom we're talking about here. But the issue here is whether this meets the definition of ameliorative, and does the addition of factors for someone older than 14, which may turn out to weigh differently in each case depending on the circumstances of a case, do what the very few laws that have actually been considered ameliorative, I don't know why I can't pronounce the word, I'm working on it, have been much more cut and dried, much more black lined.
So I actually don't think so. I think the question is it a little of this and a little of that, or is it a one-way ratchet? So when we look at the changes that were made to NERA, which this court said are not ameliorative, there was lots of relief given to folks who were charged with possession of a weapon for an unlawful purpose. They were no longer subject to NERA. There were also people who were swept in, right? This was a response to this court's decision in Manzi and so forth. So now people charged with murder were being put in. So this was the legislature saying, we don't think NERA is doing it right, but not we think NERA is too harsh. And that's different here because all of the factors that were added, Justice Patterson, are factors that favor a defendant.
But I'm concerned about the breadth of your argument about ameliorative, because you're leaping over prong one by saying there's ambiguity, I guess, in having put a prospective date in the future across the board. That's how you get to prong two for ameliorative. And it seems as if you're applying this ameliorative analysis to every juvenile who had been waived up and had penalty imposed before the date that the statute came into effect. So where does it end? How far back is this ameliorative exception going to go? 20 years?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that the ameliorative exception just gets us to the pipeline. So I don't think it's going back 20 years. I think it is to people who are in the pipeline on the effective date.
Where do you get that from, Mr. Shalom? I don't see that in the statute.
I actually do, because I think the retroactivity, not in the statute, but in the retroactivity analysis, which calls on this court to look at the manifest injustice that might be caused. And so the administrability is part of that analysis. And so I agree with Ms. Friedman's critique.
Here's a question as to whether manifest injustice applies outside of a constitutional challenge. Is there not? We can't be saying any decision that the legislature makes is manifestly unjust because we don't necessarily agree with it, can we?
Maybe I'm using that term incorrectly, Justice Levesque. What I mean by it is when you're trying to figure out whether to apply a statute retroactively, even if you decide that it's ameliorative, if the retroactive application will cause a manifest injustice, including because it's so unadministrable, then you don't apply it retroactively. So I'm actually thinking of manifest injustice as something that counsels for the state's argument, not for the defendant's argument.
It's actually an interpretive doctrine, manifest justice.
Yeah.
We're supposed to look to see whether or not the legislature would have crafted a statute which would have caused a manifest injustice. And if we came to the conclusion that they would not have wanted that result, then we would interpret the statute another way. That's the way it works.
And so I think when we talk about every 14-year-old who is either serving sentence or, frankly, just has a criminal record from a conviction from 1974, I think that's not what the legislature intended to do. I'm going to get to my last point, which I think it sums this up, which is line drawing is hard. There are going to be people on each side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the hypothetical that Ms. Friedman threw back to the court is really an important one. After the statute had passed, but before its effective date, what basis does a lawyer have to not ask the court for more time? Because another feature of this law, a feature of the waiver provision, is for the first time, waiver is not final. And that gets to Ms. Henderson's kind of alternate argument that the punishment incurred at waiver. There is waiver back under this new statute. A criminal part judge can send the case back to the family part after the guilty plea or resolution at trial to be disposed of there. So there is no finality. But because of waiver back, it's not final. There's no finality until the sentences have been imposed. And Justice Timpone, to your point, we talk always about, when we talk about the pipeline, when we talk about who's getting the impact of a court decision, we always look back to people whose cases aren't final. And by final in that context, what we mean is they haven't exhausted their direct review. If they're on collateral review, they're out. But if they're on direct review, they're not. We're not talking about
Have we routinely applied case law retroactivity analyses to statutory retroactivity analyses?
No, I'll grant that they're different. But again, we're talking about a very small pool of people here. And we're
how,
not...
How small?
So the state gives us numbers from 2 years that this straddles of 323, I believe, if you add the two. But we're not talking about the full period of either of those years, right? We're only talking about people who, because clearly if they hadn't been waived by the effective date, everyone agrees they get the benefit of the new statute. Let's say it's 323.
Can I ask you to pause on that? Why isn't it the longer period that's involved here? Why is it just the 7 months? And I heard your colleague...
So I would say it's longer than 7 months.
Okay.
But I would say, because I don't think this effective date is dispositive of the inquiry. And Justice Levesque, just to be clear, I'm not saying we jump over it. You and I might disagree about whether I surmount it, but I agree we have to get to ambiguity first. I don't say we get to avoid it. We just might disagree about whether it's there.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the period I think we're talking about, Justice Patterson. People who... So the state seems to agree that if you were waived after the effective date, then you get the benefit of the new statute. And we're saying, right, if you were waived after the effective date, March of 2016, you get the benefit of the new statute. So anyone who was waiver was in the last 3 months of 2016 is not relevant to the inquiry because everyone agrees.
Because the judge, unless they just missed the fact that the statute changed, would be applying the new statute at that
And if they did, there's relief on other grounds.
Yeah,
it's not.
But that's not even a retroactivity issue. That's
correct. That's application,
that's the application
of existing law.
Okay, so where are we?
So the question is, how many people were waived who did not have their sentence finalized, either through the pronouncement of sentence, which is the interpretation kind of put forth by many, or through the finality of their direct appeal by then? It'll be more if you're talking about direct appeal, but it's not hugely more. And this is the critical fact. The 17-year-olds who don't have cognitive limitations, the 17-year-olds who don't have developmental disabilities or mental illness, it doesn't do them any good to get
They'll
a new hearing.
They'll all apply. Look, everyone will have an incentive to ask for a new waiver hearing. That would make sense. So what I want to ask you is how this actually would work. Here we're dealing with a plea. We may be dealing with another case where there was an 8-week trial, 17-year-old, new waiver hearing, let's say, and the judge says, I think you should remain in the juvenile system. What happens to that conviction? It's got to be vacated, right?
I can't disagree with that. Whether or not the
And we would start anew. You'd have to completely start anew in the waiver hearing. He could ask for a new trial. He could plea. He could do whatever he'd want to do. But that would have to be just so we understand what the effect of this would be.
I agree. It's just, okay. But Justice Albin, that's because waivers are so important. What you're saying is this kid's whole life turns on this question, and yet we have the state pushing us to say, we now know that a better system, the legislature has told us a better system, consistent with common sense, is to consider the fact that this kid has an IQ of 58. We didn't before, but hey, you missed it by 2 months because your lawyer failed to ask for an adjournment. To me, you're just, if you adopt the state's theory, all you're doing is pushing for the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that should inevitably follow.
You mentioned that there are going to be individuals for whom those factors will not apply. Probably quite a
many,
number.
Many.
You're talking about that in terms of reducing the number. Is the statute ameliorative as to those individuals?
So just to be clear what we're talking about, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds. Because
14-year-olds
clearly
as to whom, because your argument is telling us, as a matter of fact, and there's a lot about this juvenile in the
right.
record, that this will make is likely to make a difference, okay? I assume there are going to be many, many juveniles as to whom those three factors will make no difference. Is the statute ameliorative as to that individual?
If those three factors make no difference, it is not ameliorative as to that individual.
So in order to find out if it's ameliorative, we have to look at it juvenile by juvenile? You see what I'm talking about here?
In the same way that if we think it's clearly ameliorative as for a 14-year-old who's categorically excluded from punishment, that's juvenile by juvenile. The number of factors you have to get into, I concede, in this context is far more significant than looking at the data.
But you see what I'm talking about? Your argument to fit it within the exception is very much based on the circumstances of an individual juvenile.
Well, that's right. So imagine a statute that said anyone, putting aside the arbitrariness of such a thing, anyone whose name starts A through L, the maximum penalty for a first-degree crime is now 15 years instead of 20. That is,
Mrs. Albin is okay with that.
I'm sure he is. So that cuts that is ameliorative as to A through L and has no benefit for M through C.
This is a little more complicated. This really requires almost that in order to determine the status of, under your argument, the status of the statute, we have to make some judgments as to how it's going to apply to an individual.
Well, so let me say this, Justice Patterson, because unlike the NERA example, as I said, where there was some harshness added and some leniency added, this is either lenient
or neutral.
And so I would say that makes the statute ameliorative, and some defendants might not be able to enjoy the benefit of the amelioration.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Evancher.
Chief Chief Justice, may it please the court, I appreciate the opportunity to appear amicus on behalf of the criminal defense lawyers of New Jersey. I've listened, as I know the court has, to the arguments of my colleagues, Ms. Friedman, Mr. Shalom, and with the court's permission, I will simply adopt what they have said rather than repeating any of it at this time. The only thing I would add is that as I listened to the arguments and the colloquy with the court, I was looking at the appellate division opinion, which was barely mentioned during the argument, and it occurred to me that it was the appellate division that decided on the enactment date of the new statute rather than the effective date. And perhaps that was simply a blatant error by the court, but it caused me to wonder, and I don't know that anyone has raised this, and it may not be worth raising, but I wonder, when speaking about effectiveness, if there could be a legitimate argument made that it was the enactment date that was tantamount to the effectiveness, and the term effective with respect to 7 months must have meant something else, but not the traditional, that's when the statute will be given effect. I don't know. That may not be worthy of my having said it, although I just did. But I would like to say that the legislature, and I've read some of the statements of Senator Pooh, I think it was, who was the sponsor of the enactment, was obviously proud, at least it seemed obvious to me, that they had fashioned this new statute, designed really in the final analysis, I believe, to effectuate rehabilitation of juveniles. If it works as it was intended to, such rehabilitation will occur in the future. So it's an important statute, and one which I think, if there's a way to do it, could be said to have been effective the day the governor signed it into law. In any event, I thank the court for its attention.
Thank you. Ms. Henderson, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be quick. I just have a few points. The first thing I want to make clear is that it was never said that we felt defendant gamed the system. I think that's an unfair comment. It was simply asked when he filed the appeal. He didn't have an appeal pending on the effective date. He filed it later. There's no sinister motive to say defendant gamed the system. Clearly, if he was allowed to file it out of time, he was allowed to file it out of time. And there's no connotation to anything on his behalf that's saying that we're reading anything into that. It's simply a matter of fact. There wasn't an appeal. There's one now.
We accept that as to both sides of the aisle.
Okay. Another point just on defendant, before I get to the statute, is that the juvenile court did have information on his background. They did have information about his mental disabilities. They did have a special education. If you look at the transcript on 1T89-16 to 92-8, the court says there were prior hearings on this case, and he does suffer a significant problem. He does have an IQ of 58, and I think the court's seen through the voluminous documents that have been going back and forth, as well as the competency evaluation, that he is operating at a low level, and he's been in a special school, and they knew about the suicides.
But under the old regime, it was just the prosecutor's call, and under the new regime, the court has the ability to make the call.
Absolutely, but I think what it shows, and again, we don't have the transcripts, we just have this, is that defense counsel tried to get the information to the prosecutor to convince them not to do the waiver. I mean, that's the only where that would have effect, because he was over 16, so the judge was not making a determination of whether or not there's a prospect of rehabilitation. But the fact that all this information had been submitted was obviously submitted in an attempt to convince the prosecutor's office not to waive. But that's a separate matter. I mean, really, this case is, where do we draw the line on the prospective application of the statute? And it always has been, with the savings clause, the effective date of the statute, the legislative intent, the penalty is incurred, and if there's any proceedings going on. That's the end of it. I mean, they're trying to extend the effective date of the statute to saying that let's look at retroactivity in constitutional principles that weren't statutory and say, let's look at, you know, the factors and decide if it should be completely pending, whatever. And no matter where you draw the line, unless it's complete, and we're complete, like, with, you know, for anybody who's still alive who was waived up as a juvenile, there is a line somewhere that somewhere is going to be treated unfairly under their terms. And in this case, it doesn't help that it's final for him because he's already been waived up and sentenced, that for them it has to be pending on appeal. If it's someone else where they were in a different part of the system, it may apply to them. But in terms of looking at what's considered a pending case, again, when you look at Chambers, when you look at Dussault, when you look at some of the other cases, they say that it's final at the time sentence is imposed. And that was always been considered final. And that pending, it's no longer pending when sentence is imposed. And that was the exact argument in Dussault, saying, oh, it's on appeal, it should be considered pending. And the appellate division said, no. It says it's no longer pending once it's final. And it has to be final in order to appeal. So finality has always been when the sentence is imposed. And there's always going to be some people that don't get the benefit of the statute. And I was just talking about the adjournment scenario. The adjournment scenario doesn't apply to this defendant. He was waived up in 2013. I don't even know if the statute was being considered at that time, but it was certainly 2 years before the statute took effect. And to say that during that seven-month period that every defense counsel should have moved to adjourn the waiver hearings until the new statute took effect, well, then essentially we'd have the juvenile courts doing nothing for 7 months, and that's not even saying that all these juveniles would have been waived up. But and that's the other thing. Even under the new system, even if they bring in the additional information, there's no guarantee that they're not going to be waived up. That still has to be decided in the discretion of the judge. I think that's all I have to say, unless there's any questions.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter.